This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area Monday, February 4th, 2013. The North Fork Valley was in the news over the weekend as the New York Times ran an article in the front section about the fight against the gas leases here, complete with photos. You can find it online at newyorktimes.com. I'm sorry, NYTIMES.com. In a related story, the Western Organization of Resource Councils has found growth in active oil and gas wells is mostly outpacing the increases in the number of state inspectors in Colorado and four nearby states. According to the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, that same report found that the Bureau of Land Management generally boosted its ratio of inspectors to wells from 2007 to 2010 before the ratio dropped again. It found that four states, Wyoming, Montana, New Mexico, and Colorado, didn't have enough inspectors to inspect all active wells at least once a year. The report by WORC, W-O-R-C, a network of citizens groups including the Western Colorado Congress, states that is also true for the BLM. The study found that on average in 2011, each Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission inspector was responsible for more than 5,200 active wells, compared to about 3,400 wells 2 years earlier. On average, Colorado inspectors conducted more than 1,300 inspections in 2011, the report said. It also said that at that rate, a well typically would be inspected about once every 4 years. In the BLM's silt-based Colorado River Valley field office, the average inspections per full-time equivalent inspector topped 3,000 per year in fiscal years 2010 and 11. In a news release, the Western Colorado Congress and WORC pointed to the study results in citing leeriness over the BLM's proposed leasing of 20,000 acres for oil and gas development in the North Fork Valley. North Fork Valley resident Gretchen Nikoloff said in the release, quote, "If BLM leases a North Fork, they must provide for more inspections and penalties to deter violations and protect our clean air, clean water, and public health," end quote. BLM spokesman Stephen Hall claimed the agency has an exemplary track record of managing energy development in Colorado and the North Fork Valley and said, quote, "Given that inspections are most useful during the actual drilling and initial production of federal wells, simply visiting a well every year may not be the best use of public resources," end quote. The gun debate will be one of the central issues during the state's legislative session, and lawmakers have already heard the first Republican proposals. They both failed along party lines and highlight the wide difference between Democrats and the GOP when it comes to tackling gun violence. Benta Berkland discusses the dynamics as part of our Capital Conversation series.
Democrats have already struck down two Republican bills that would have increased the use of concealed guns as a way to protect children and people at businesses. To talk about the issue, we're joined by Tim Hoover with the Denver Post and Charles Ashby with the Grand Junction Sentinel. I don't think any of us were surprised that these Republican proposals were defeated along party lines. Charles?
No, not at all. And we're not done with them yet. There's another one that's been introduced that is a mirror of the first bill that got killed, which was the one to arm teachers or to allow teachers to conceal carry. So they're not giving up on that issue, especially now that they're now starting to talk about it in Congress. Some of this is because, you know, they generally believe that this is good policy. For some, it's just constituent bills that they promised that they would run as an alternative to what the Democrats would want to do, even though they have no chance.
Tim, do you think we're going to see any bipartisan support on gun legislation this session? From what we've seen so far, a lot of Republicans believe that more guns will help people defend themselves and make everyone safer, where some of the Democrats are saying the last thing we need are more guns. Is there any middle ground?
I doubt it. I think that what Democrats are talking about is universal background checks on gun sales. Now, we have to see the specific language on that and how that's exactly going to work. But I have doubts as to whether any Republican will support that. The other thing that's being talked about a lot is a ban or prohibition of some sort on high-capacity gun magazines. And again, I just have my doubts that it'll see very much Republican support, if any.
I know we still haven't seen the Democratic bills yet. From what we've heard from legislative leaders, they're working on a big comprehensive package. Do both of you think they're just trying to iron out all the differences among Democrats to just be completely uniform and in sync on what they want to do?
I think what the Democrats want to do is to be uniform and have their message crafted, because this is more about politics, or just as much about politics as it is about policy for them. And I don't think they're entirely sure what they want to do yet. I don't know if they want to go after assault weapons. I don't know if there's any agreement on the high-capacity magazines. They may be so high that it really means nothing. I don't know if they even have an answer on the universal background check, because one aspect of that might call for, you know, gun registration of everybody who has a gun, and that's a non-starter for Republicans. In the meantime, we've got battling House and Senate, and we've seen this before in the past, leadership in the House and the Senate, where we've got a Senate president who claims to be the one guy who knows more about anything when it comes to gun control because he's a former cop. And we've got Democrats who, you know, in the House who are just not on the same page when it comes to what they want to do on the gun side of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's really important to note is that it's not as if Democrats are, you know, have a monolithic position on this. You know, let's don't forget there are many sort of, for lack of a better term, pro-gun Democrats. Some of them have to be talked to, and I don't doubt that they're trying to figure out what's going to be palatable to the majority of Democrats. What might the governor go for? And also, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some quiet polling happening right now to see what the public might be willing to stomach.
Do you agree with Charles that it's as much about politics as policy?
It totally is, which is why I think that they're unlikely to make a move until they're really sure how they think it's likely to play. What they don't want is to come out and have the Democrats be fighting each other and to give the Republicans any sort of wiggle room to say, aha, you can't even get your own stuff together. And they also, I think, want to figure out, you know, what might be okay with the public.
It should come as no surprise to anyone that the one thing that they have, one aspect of this that they have agreed on is the mental health stuff. It's not gun control, for one thing. And it's easy to say this is something that we need to focus on, and everybody agrees on that. But the problem with that has always been the money aspect of it. If you're going to see any bipartisan support, it's going to be on that side of it.
Something we'll all follow closely this session, I'm sure. Charles Ashby with the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel and Tim Hoover with the Denver Post. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver, and this is Capital Conversation.
The Denver Post reports that, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, about 3.6% of people who pass through Colorado's background check for gun purchases are denied, the third highest rate in the country. However, the data also show that Colorado has a higher percentage of denials overturned on appeal than any other state. Colorado is one of 13 so-called point-of-contact states where purchasers of handguns and long guns apply through local law enforcement rather than directly to the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation handles background checks for the federal firearms licensees, running applications through a combination of state and NICS records during the review. But the system, federal or local, is only as good as the data placed in it. About 58.8% of denials that were appealed in Colorado were overturned. Between 2000 and 2009, 31.9% of 17,000 denials were appealed. Although no legislation has been introduced at the State House, some Republican lawmakers are contemplating abandoning the InstaCheck system in favor of the federal program. The Telluride Daily Planet reports a bill that would encourage small hydroelectric power projects has cleared the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee. The Hydropower Regulatory Efficiency Act of 2013 may be put to a vote soon. Last year, the House unanimously passed a bill with identical wording, but it failed to pass the Senate. The bill simplifies the permitting of small hydroelectric power projects that generate fewer than 5 megawatts of electricity. With Colorado's many small streams and rivers, The Small Hydro Association estimates that around 200 megawatts of new potential hydroelectric development is possible in the state. Only about 3% of the nation's 80,000 dams currently generate hydropower, according to the bill. U.S. Representative Diana DeGette, a Democrat from Colorado, and U.S. Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican from Washington, co-sponsored the bill, and one of its major supporters is the Colorado Small Hydro Association. Kurt Johnson, who is president of the Colorado Small Hydro Association, said ideally the bill would be before the Senate by this spring or early summer. According to The Planet, smaller hydroelectric projects are currently subject to an extensive and costly federal review process that can take years. The Small Hydro Association says the current review process is geared toward large-scale projects, and it is poorly suited for smaller ones that have significantly less impact. As written, the bill would still require a review by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and public comment periods on potential projects. The Small Hydro Association says many of the low-impact projects it has identified include converting existing non-powered dams into power-generating ones. Last week on I See Change, KVNF's own Amber McDaniel had a question, and Jason Beeson of the Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory had answers.
This past summer, in about July, we made bird feeders. Well, the birds never touched them. They sat in the tree for 6 months uneaten. On January 27th, I went outside that morning and I found about 15 birds sitting in the tree, finally eating the birdseed. So my question is, why are the birds just now eating the birdseed?
Snow finally started falling and then covering up everything. They were just desperate for food and kind of happened at my feeder too. They just invaded and I've been going through a lot of birdseed. I just bought another bag at Farm and Home 10 minutes ago. And now it's like the more you go through winter before things start growing again, the more desperate they become. The most common ones that come to feeders around here are probably the dark-eyed juncos. There's some that breed in Colorado in the mountains and they just come lower in the winter for food. And then a lot of them do migrate from Canada, perhaps Alaska, then come here for the winter. There's a number of bird species where this is their winter destination. You know, it's like gone to Arizona for them. House finches is another species. They're, you know, kind of the reddish. Some of them are kind of drab. The young ones are the females. Chickadees, of course, there's some birds that just don't migrate at all and kind of stay in the same area as the magpies. And most of the corvids are the, you know, like ravens, crows. They don't come to feeders, of course. Sometimes you'll see Steller's jays or ones that are up in the mountains. They come to my feeder every now and then. It's pretty rare, but, you know, they'll come lower. There's birds that breed way up north in the boreal forest called common redpolls. And there's another species, hoary redpoll. They're all over the state this winter, which is really interesting. It's one of the best, you know, what they call it, eruptions. The species typically will maybe just go as far south as Montana, and now they're pushing way down in Colorado, and there are a lot of them. There's people in the Front Range where they're reporting, you know, hundreds coming to their feeder, 20 or 30 or something like that. And I've seen two, just one on, you know, a day in December and then one in January in my yard, you know, just about a mile west of Peonia. They're desperate for food also and looking for something to eat, and they're probably hundreds of thousands or millions of them, and they just push each other further south trying to find food. Hopefully it's not going to result in a large reduction in their population, but, you know, it's probably a stressful time for them.
You know, it has me thinking about putting out a little bit more birdseed.
I think in the wintertime, you know, why not? Because they're looking for food, and I feel like humans have altered habitats so much that if we have the ability to help them, why not?
Meanwhile, this week in Florida, trees appear to be blossoming early. Now, if we get another early spring here in Colorado, what will you do this year that's different from last? Tell us at www.thealmanac.org, where you can be a part of the I See Change discussion. Thus concludes this morning's newscast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Brian Cambria, and this is KVNF, two-way radio for Western Colorado.